I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. After a 5-week trial, a jury in Seminole County found George Zimmerman not guilty of second-degree murder in the shooting death of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The incident and the trial sparked debate on issues of race and injustice both in Central Florida and across the US. To talk more about how perceptions of race played a role in this case, I'll speak with Kareem Jordan, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Central Florida. Also, the NAACP is the oldest and largest civil rights organization in the United States, and its annual convention is in Orlando for the first time. I'll speak with Marvin Randolph, Senior Vice President of Campaigns, and Sammy Dow, National Youth and College Director, about civil rights in Florida and the NAACP's initiatives and plans for the future. That's ahead on Intersection. Well, I'm joined in the studio now by Kareem Jordan. Dr. Jordan is an associate professor in the Criminal Justice Department at the University of Central Florida, and he specializes in the perception of race in criminal trials. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's look back at this case. After deliberating for 16 hours, the jury in the trial of George Zimmerman found him not guilty of second-degree murder and manslaughter. Do you think the jury came to the right decision here?
Based on how this self-defense law is written, the verdict was the correct verdict. Now, ask whether or not that was a just verdict is a different question, but whether or not the verdict was correct based on Florida's self-defense laws, I do think it was the correct verdict.
Now, you would have been following the case fairly closely. Were there any surprises that came up throughout the deliberation and then the verdict when it came through late Saturday evening?
I was a little bit surprised only because when the jury came back with that question about the instruction on manslaughter at that particular point, I think like many people in the world, I thought that they were considering manslaughter in terms of that being their verdict. So I was a bit surprised when they came back with the straight not guilty on any charge. And again, of course, not guilty doesn't mean he's innocent, just the prosecution didn't meet his burden.
Defense attorney Mark O'Meara described the case as a David and Goliath struggle. The defense prevailed in the end. Is that a fair reflection of the case, do you think? Did it seem like a David and Goliath struggle where the defense was on the back foot?
I do. You know, I don't necessarily agree with Mark O'Meara on quite a few things, but that's one of the ones I actually do agree with him on. The state has a lot of resources at its disposal in terms of experts, in terms of finances, in terms of the resources that they have available to them. Because, again, this is the state of Florida, even though it's within one circuit, but it is the state of Florida against a particular person. While defense attorneys, they are more limited in terms of, you know, once they run out of money, then they may not be able to have enough money to pay for an expert or to pay for the exhibits or the boards that they'll put up there in terms of the demonstrations and everything else. So in that sense, I do think it was a David and Goliath, because even though the quality of Zimmerman's attorneys are pretty high, just in terms of resources, they don't have the unlimited type of resources that are available to the state of Florida.
Did you get the sense that there was any one key argument that might have swung the jury one way or the other throughout the three some weeks of testimony we heard?
I think there were just a series of small things. I don't think it was one particular thing that swayed the jury towards a not guilty verdict. I do think it was a series of things. For instance, when they put out the statements, all the statements that George Zimmerman made over the course of, I guess, the first few weeks after the shooting had took place, in terms of the interview with Fox News, in terms of all the statements he made to the police, because it was the prosecution that entered in that evidence. So because they entered that evidence in, George Zimmerman's story was out there. He did not have to testify. Now, I do understand what the prosecution was trying to do with that. They was trying to say because there were these inconsistencies within his story, it's hard to say it was self-defense because the story changed a few times. But between that and maybe the quality of some of the people who testified on behalf of the state, they weren't exactly as strong as I think the state would have liked. So if you put those factors together, you know, I honestly do think that the state did the best that they could given the evidence that they had.
Angela Corey made the comment after the case that it was difficult for them, partly because they were coming in onto an investigation that had been started by another agency and they were picking it up. Do you feel, on reflecting back on this case, that there were mistakes made in the initial stages?
Well, it was a tough thing. At least of the evidence that came out during the trial, it did seem there were some missteps during the investigation right after the shooting. One of the things that came out during the trial is that his hands weren't backed, that Trayvon Martin's hands, they weren't backed. You know, with the hands not being backed, they may have lost some evidence. What are you talking about? Some evidence under his fingernails because it was raining outside and those types of things. How long he was out there prior to being taken to the medical examiner, he was out there, I think they said, about 2.5 to 3 hours. Also, when the tape of the shooting that had somebody screaming in the background, when that was played for the family, law enforcement weren't inside the room. So it was hard for them to attest as to whether or not at least the integrity of the identification of Trayvon Martin being that voice who was screaming, because law enforcement weren't there. It was kind of hard for them to say, okay, yes, they heard it for the first time during this moment. Nobody else was in the room and they identified that this was the voice of Trayvon Martin. It was hard for those things to come into evidence without question.
And that was a key point in the trial. Both sides, both George Zimmerman's family were adamant that it was him, his voice you could hear, and of course Trayvon Martin's parents were adamant that it was their son they could you could hear in the background of that tape.
It was, and again, just because of how, even though I believe whenever the mayor and the city manager had played that tape for the family, their hearts were in the right place. It was saying, you know, we don't want you to hear this for the first time within the media, on TV or on the radio, so let me play it for you now, just so you're not surprised for whenever it comes out. So their heart was in the right place. But when it comes to the investigation, that did taint that identification to some extent. So even though people's heart was in the right place, there were these initial missteps that I believe made it hard for the state attorneys in the Fourth Circuit to prosecute this case. Doesn't mean that the investigators did a poor job by any means, but there were a couple of missteps, so it seems.
How much of an influence do you think it has, the fact that there was all this national and even international attention on this case? Does that change the way things are done?
I think it could, but in this case, I don't necessarily think that it did. Neither side really tried this case in the media. Everyone else did. But in terms of the influence that the media had on this case, in terms of how it was tried, I really don't think that it had any.
Now, you talked about the way the jury may have interpreted the law and come to that decision, and you bring up the issue of self-defense and Florida's self-defense laws. Do you think, looking back at this case, those laws need another look?
Yes. Now, I don't think that laws need to change based on one particular case, but at the same time, I do think it's because of how a case may turn out, certain laws should at least get a second look or a third look. Because here is a case where you had a young male walking home from the store, minding his business, and now that young man is dead. And the person who shot him, who killed him, was acquitted based on self-defense laws. I do think that a case like this should result in at least these self-defense laws getting a second look in this state and other states.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking with Dr. Kareem Jordan, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Central Florida. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. After the verdict came down, Mark O'Meara made the comment that this case was never a case of civil rights. He said that it was a self-defense case. What's your response to that? Do you think that's an accurate statement?
I think the way the case was argued, it had nothing to do with race. As to whether or not this case truly did have something to do with race, it had everything to do with race. The reason why George Zimmerman followed Trayvon Martin in the first place and called the police had nothing to do with the actions of Trayvon Martin. He was on his way back home. So, no, I don't agree with Mark O'Meara in terms of race had nothing to do with this case. Again, they argued it as though it didn't. But even during the trial, they brought up the demographics of those who were arrested for crime within that community. And the defense did try to minimize and say, well, Trayvon Martin met those demographics. so they can understand why George Zimmerman had called the police in the first place. So this case had everything to do with race.
Now, George Zimmerman is a free man. He's been acquitted by a jury of his peers. Don't you think it's time to leave him alone? I mean, I'm sure his lawyers would argue that he should be left in peace now.
Right, and that's a legitimate position. You know, a lot of folks will say that he was acquitted and let him go. George Zimmerman was acquitted of killing Trayvon Martin on a state level in terms of murder in the second degree and manslaughter. In terms of a civil rights issue, that wasn't what the state was taking a look at. They were trying to hold him accountable just for the killing itself. Mm-hmm. If the Department of Justice gets involved, it wouldn't be a murder case. It would be a civil rights case, just like if the Martin family chose to pursue, or at least try to pursue, civil charges against George Zimmerman. That would be a civil issue, not mm-hmm. a murder issue, not a civil rights issue. So I think we have these different laws on different levels. Just for this reason, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with double jeopardy. He's not being mm-hmm. tried twice for the same offense. It's a different issue around the same event.
But in terms of bringing a civil lawsuit or civil lawsuits, Mark O'Meara made the comment again after the verdict that if any of those are brought, they will bring up the issue of self-defense and those lawsuits will be defeated.
Yeah, he did. And he could be right. But again, he could be wrong. That all depends on whatever the judge says whenever they get to that point, if they get to that point. Because as we have learned, a lot of these outcomes are based on the interpretation that folks have. And a judge may have a different interpretation in terms of civil lawsuits than what Mark O'Meara has.
Now, do you get the sense that race had anything to do with bringing this case to trial, bringing it as far as it got?
I do think that the outcry, the public outcry, once the shooting occurred is what brought this case to the current point, at least to the point of there being an arrest. And this isn't necessarily a knock on the Seminole County Sheriff or the Sanford Police Department. I think they did the best job that they could. But at the same time, the public, once the shooting occurred, only saw that you had an unarmed teen who was shot and killed by a grown man, regardless of race, and an arrest not occur. And I think that was a hard pill for a lot of folks to swallow, mm-hmm. saying that how can somebody say, yes, I shot this person, and for that person to go home? Yes, he was taken down to the station in question, but no formal arrest had taken place. And I think that was a tough pill for a lot of people to swallow. Even research that I've done examined whether or not people thought that race had a factor to do with the shooting. And the research findings of that study found that blacks were more likely than whites to believe that race was a factor in the shooting. Mm-hmm. And now most whites still also believe that race was a factor in the shooting, but at least in terms of comparing races, blacks were more likely than both Hispanics and whites to believe that race was a factor in the shooting. And that public outcry that occurred as a result of that from all races, the marches, the protests, and the rallies, I do think that put pressure on the state to do something about this, because there was this perception of inaction mm-hmm. on the part of the local law enforcement.
When the case was originally portrayed in the media, it was a case of a white man shooting a black youth, but it turns out that George Zimmerman is Hispanic. Did that sort of change the way people thought about it, you think?
I actually don't. Even though George Zimmerman is partially Hispanic, I think that by the time this case got to the point of a trial and everything else, that George Zimmerman was still just looked at as a white man who shot a unarmed black teen. So I don't necessarily think that his heritage of being Hispanic actually played any sense of how the rest of society have viewed this case.
Well, I want to ask you too, Dr. Jordan, about this idea of what might have happened in the aftermath of the verdict. How do you think the issue of race played into the way that was framed? Even the very fact that there was the suggestion that there could be some form of unrest, what is the importance of race in that discussion?
Race is huge in that discussion. I think that it was this subtle, implicit form of racism at the very suggestion that there would be some type of unrest within the community. If you look at the history of this country, black folks have suffered injustice tremendously. And for the sheer bulk of those times, there has not been any, there may have been some unrest, but not when it's spilled into the street and you have some riots and violence and those types of things. That was the sheer exception to the norm. So in this case, even though I think on some level people's hearts were in the right place saying, you know, we just don't want anything bad to happen, mm-hmm. the sheer suggestion that when it comes to an African-American teen being killed, that the black community was going to go crazy and go out into the streets, I think the sheer suggestion of that implies that you need to watch out for black folks because something could go wrong and they'll riot and can be violent. What does that say that you feel, you know, about blacks, that blacks have this propensity towards being violent in the community? And I think that's a problem.
Now that the criminal case is finished, do you think this can be a catalyst for change in Sanford and in Florida?
This trial brings more things to light than what folks see. You know, unless you study the criminal justice system and those types of things, people may not be able to see those injustices as much and how frequently they occur. People see them within their neighborhood when it comes to relationships with the police or those types of things. But prior to this case, a lot of people used to just think, well, that's just an inner city issue. But we're talking about Sanford and a community, at least that the shooting took place, it was a middle class type of area. So I think that the impact of this verdict is spread the conversation beyond just, for instance, poor blacks, where now the middle class blacks and upper class blacks will now be having more conversations with their kids than they were before this verdict.
I've been speaking with Kareem Jordan. He is an associate professor in the Criminal Justice Department at the University of Central Florida, and he specializes in the perception of race in criminal trials. I want to thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Had a great time.
Coming up, the NAACP talks about voting rights and how the Trayvon Martin case has galvanized the young members of the organization. The NAACP's annual conference is in Orlando this week. The conference, called We Shall Not Be Moved, focuses on what the association calls modern-day attempts to roll back the progress of the civil rights era. I spoke with Marvin Randolph, Senior Vice President of Campaigns, about the challenges of voter registration.
In terms of registering people to vote, I know that you were quite active last year and you had a lot of folks registered to vote. Tell me about how Florida fits into that picture.
We ran the most legendary historic campaign that we've ever built around civic engagement, not just registering people to vote, but turning them out. We actually turned out more people in the field than any other national group across the nation, 366,828 voters. And out of that number, there were 118,828 that came from the state of Florida. It was by far our largest operation. And what's interesting about Florida is that it's one of the places where the law was the most restrictive. It was one of the examples where the voting rights laws that were put on the Bush books had a backlash, and people, instead of being intimidated, they stayed in line, and we saw historic numbers.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of why you were so successful in Florida? Was it the fact that there were these restrictive laws? Is that what motivated people to turn out and vote in spite of that?
Well, I think that in Florida and in all the states across the nation where we had really big results, there were a few reasons. I mean, certainly having an African-American on the ticket made a difference. You know, certainly the backlash to people that felt like folks were trying to repress their vote. But the real story is that groups like the NAACP and partners that we had in the field saw these voting rights attacks coming a year and a half ago. And we built the most coordinated, comprehensive campaign that we've ever built. This was the most systematic, coordinated, well-funded voting rights suppression campaign we've seen since the days of the old Southern Jim Crow. And we had to build a systematic, coordinated response. And so we did things that weren't just shoe leather, going to people's doors and registering them or sitting in front of a grocery store and registering them. We also found all of the African-American students that were turning 18 that year. And we sent them a pre-populated registration form. And we called them and asked them to pledge to turn those forms in. We partnered with churches. We used a voter registration system that was online where we could match congregation lists with registered voters lists so people knew who wasn't registered. Worked with fraternities and sororities. We had an 866 number that you could call and we would send you a form. We had an online registration piece that you could use. So we had to move into the 21st century with our techniques while we were fighting restrictive laws. And what's particularly interesting about Florida is that what they did in Florida and what they said afterwards. Florida's law said that if you were going to register voters, you had to be with a third-party organization that was registered with the state. And so you couldn't just go out and hand out a registration form. You had to be with an organization that was officially registered with the state. If you did not turn in a form within 48 hours, you got a $50 fine as an individual for every form that was late. And so on Martin Luther King Day is a Monday. That weekend, we did registration on a Saturday. We went to turn the forms in on Tuesday because the office was closed, and the sheriff from one of the counties threatened to fine us. And when we asked, what should we do, we were told, you should have shoved them under the door. Can you imagine if we'd have shoved registration forms with sensitive information? So this was the fight that we waged. And many groups pulled out. The League of Women Voters decided not to stay. Many people didn't stay in Florida, but we stayed and we pushed through. Mm-hmm. So I would say there were those three regions, but it was really the fight back.
What do you make of what's happened since then in Florida? For example, there were concerns about the cutting down the number of voting days, but now Florida's Governor Rick Scott has said we will extend those voting days again, give people more chances to get to the polls. Is that a victory in your eyes?
Yes, it is, and we applaud the governor for making that decision. We think that voting should be something that's easier and not harder, and we appreciate any elected official. We're nonpartisan in everything that we do, but whatever their stripes are, whatever side of the aisle they're on, if they're doing something good that's making voting easier, that's a good thing. So we certainly applaud the governor for that. You know, and I think one of the things that you will find in Florida and all across the nation was that early voting was actually up by, I think it was like 16% higher than it was in 2008. And this was a year when, if you recall, everybody was saying they thought that there was going to be an enthusiasm gap with African Americans, and it was actually the opposite. You know, people like my mother, who's not from Florida, but just weren't going to wait for someone to tell them that they couldn't vote. Those folks came early and got in line to make sure if there was a problem, they were going to find out early. And it was certainly the historic nature of this election. It was certainly a backlash to the voting rights things. The backlash had a backlash. But it was also that we spent a year and a half educating people on what the rules were, what the laws were. And we made sure that when they got in line on election day, they didn't just get a text saying stay in line. They got a text saying stay in this line and here are the rules in this line. And here's what you can do if you have a problem in this line. Here's how you can get an attorney if someone tries to push you out of this line. And so we had to push really hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes what has happened with the Supreme Court very interesting, because African-American turnout was higher than it's ever been. It was statistically a larger percentage of African-Americans turned out to vote than white people or any other ethnicity for the first time ever. And it's very interesting that people are using that as a reason to say that we don't need the Voting Rights Act, when it's actually those protections and the fact that those were on the rolls that allowed us to do what we did.
Do you feel like that was a mistake to roll that back?
Oh, absolutely. The Voting Rights Act is a cornerstone of justice for people of color. It is what requires states that have had a history of doing things that are repressive just to let the Justice Department know if they want to make a change. And if it's a fine change, it's approved. If it's a difficult change, it's going to make it, if they're going to take a poll and move it across town the day before the election, that's probably not going to get through. What's interesting, though, is that since the Supreme Court made this decision, and what they did was they did not take Section 5, which is the part of the law that says that states need to get pre-approval before they make changes. They took Section 4, which is the part of the law that says here is the formula that determines which states do this. But that formula, until it's enacted, Section 5 doesn't apply to anyone. And so hours after that, in many states like Texas, there were restrictive laws that are put on the books. And you know, in Texas, you can bring a gun ID and use that as ID to register to vote, but you can't bring a student ID. In North Carolina, if you are a parent and you have a child that is in college in another state and they go to register to vote in that state where they go to school, you lose a tax credit. You know, they're taking money out of your pocket. And we have found that, you know, we talk a lot about history at the NAACP. We talk about Jim Crow and things that people may not remember so much, but the truth is that Jim Crow has just become James Crow Esquire. It's the same old Jim dressed up in a fancy suit, but it's the same rules. These are restrictive laws that are designed to inconvenience people that have less money, people that have less access, people that have less time to go to the DMV and spend the day trying to get a very expensive ID, or an ID that requires a lot of other documents that they don't have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was NAACP's Senior Vice President of Campaigns, Marvin Randolph. I also spoke with the Association's National Youth and College Director, Sammy Dow. I began by asking whether the not guilty verdict in George Zimmerman's second-degree murder trial has overshadowed the conference.
I'd first say that I don't think that convention has been overshadowed by the verdict. I think that the timing has been ideal. I think it's provided a great platform and opportunity for our delegates and for our folks in attendance to be together at one time and able to discuss this in mass. And so I think that there has been a benefit in having that. I think our folks were initially shocked and stunned, which I don't think is a surprise. I think our folks were shocked and stunned, but more importantly than that, I think they were called to act. And so what we're now doing is we're building off of the momentum and the desire and the passion to act and to mobilize yet again. We saw folks for the NAACP act and mobilize last year when we felt that George Zimmerman should be arrested and should be charged with the murder of Trayvon Martin. And so our folks are again ready to act, call on the Department of Justice to investigate the possibility of civil rights violations committed by Mr. Zimmerman. And that's where our people are. We are stunned. Some folks are shocked and saddened by the decision. But more so than that, we recognize that this is yet a call to action in the larger fight and pursuit for justice in this country.
Would you say that the case has been a sort of a rallying point or a point of galvanization for younger folk coming into the organization?
I think I would agree with that. I think it's been a rallying point and somewhat of a call to action for young people, because I think it's a realization that Trayvon Martin was 17 years old, walking from a convenience store after having purchased candy and something to drink. And I think that young people affiliated with the NAACP can relate to that, because all of us know what it's like to walk with friends or by ourselves after having purchased something from a local convenience store, recognizing that that could have been us.
And leading up to the trial, throughout the trial, there were calls for calm. There were comments by the parents of Trayvon Martin, also the parents, of course, of George Zimmerman. Let the court process work its course. And officials were saying that too. Now that that's all happened, though, there is this feeling that it doesn't end here.
It doesn't end here. And that's why the NAACP, with immediately following the verdict, released our statement regarding the verdict. And we're deeply saddened and hurt by the verdict. Quite honestly, heartbroken by the verdict. But we're going to continue to stand for justice with Trayvon Martin's family. And that's why we released our petition calling on the Department of Justice to act in this case and to investigate and bring civil rights charges against Mr. Zimmerman. And within hours of releasing that petition, over 130,000 people had signed that petition within just a matter of hours, because people recognize that this is a case that we have to stand for. And in the history of our civil rights movement, in the history of the NAACP, we'll do so in a way that's nonviolent and that remains peaceful, but that agitates for the change that we hope to achieve.
What's your sense of the likelihood of a case like that succeeding?
We remain confident that with the agitation and with the mobilization of our NAACPers across the country, we're hopeful. We're hopeful and we're optimistic that we will see justice in this case.
That was Sammy Dow, the NAACP National Youth and College Director at the Association's annual conference in Orlando. Conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.